And let me just give you some context here. So for this textbook, the Lessons for the Young Economist, obviously it couldn't include everything. I had to teach the basics, the mechanics of how do prices work, how do you use supply and demand charts, that sort of thing. And then I had to pick some topics. And I talked last week, I explained why drug prohibition got in there. And so for this this topic as well, inflation, I thought that was really important. The people, the average person, if he or she just takes one course in economics, that I thought you need to walk away from such a course knowing why are prices always going up? Like, what's the source of that? And so that's what we're talking about in today's lecture. All right, so the first thing I want to explain is what I'm here calling the old switcheroo. And what I mean by this is that the very term inflation, its definition has changed over the decades. All right, so it used to mean one thing, the way economists and financial analysts used to use the term. And nowadays, most people, when they use the word inflation, they mean something that's different. And so let me explain what those two meanings are and then give you some a theory as to why that change happened. Okay, so first of all, inflation used to mean an expansion in the quantity of money, or some people might include credit in there, so an expansion in the quantity of money and credit. All right, so the idea was that the stock of money is inflating. So there, you know, under that definition, right now, or since 2008, we've had significant inflation in the United States because Ben Bernanke has been flooding the economy with new money that he's creating. All right, so that's what inflation traditionally meant, and you know, that's what the economists, so back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that's if you just saw an economist talking about inflation, that's probably what he meant, that it was an expansion of the stock of money or the quantity of money. But nowadays, when people talk about inflation and they say, hey, what was the inflation rate last year? Or, oh man, you think there's going to be, you know, inflation? What do you think inflation is going to be like this coming year? That kind of thing. Or they'll say, do you think Bernanke is setting us up for big time inflation? What does that mean? Well, people mean price inflation. They mean that rising prices. All right, so what in my own writings, I try to avoid confusion by always using the adjective. So I'll refer to monetary inflation, or I'll say inflation of, you know, the money supply, or inflation of the credit, or something like that. And but if I mean inflation the way Joe Boyle probably means it, I'll usually put in the adjective price inflation, just to make sure that everybody knows what I'm talking about. Now, what's the big deal? Well, here I'm showing, in case it's not obvious, what this picture is. It's the Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain there. The reason this is significant is that if you define inflation as rising prices, in a sense, you're looking at the results, you're looking at the symptom rather than the cause. Okay, because we'll see in a minute, one of the, when you're trying to understand, you know, why is it that prices just keep going up year after year? Why is it that a dollar today can buy a lot less than a dollar from 1900 could, or, you know, whatever country you're in, whatever currency unit your country uses? If you go back 10 years, prices quoted in that currency are going to be lower, meaning that the purchasing power of your money goes down over time. And that's something that has been true for just, you know, all developed countries since probably World War II and perhaps earlier. So, but yeah, actually probably my guess would be since the late 1930s. So, you know, why is this? And we'll see one of the main explanations for this is that the various central banks and governments who are in charge of controlling the stock of money, they have let that stock of money continually grow year after year after year. And that's, you know, the single most important part of the explanation as to why is it that the purchasing power of money goes down year after year after year. Right? But if you, so if you define inflation as increasing the quantity of money, well, then it's obvious who the culprit is. When you're trying to understand what's going on here, you say, well, is there inflation? Yeah, they've been pumping a lot of new money into the economy. All right, so there it focuses your attention on that aspect of it. Whereas if inflation is defined as just this general increase in prices, it's a lot harder for the public to figure out who's to blame. Because there they're going to look at the merchants who are raising the prices, or they might get mad at the unions for demanding wage hikes, or they might get mad at the OPEC countries for restricting oil output and pushing up the price. All right, but there's all sorts of things going on to affect the particular prices, whereas when you want to understand why is it that there's a trillion more dollars in existence this year than last year, you know that, well, Ben Bernanke had a lot to do with that. All right, so that's, I think, part of what's going on behind this trend is that just as there's all sorts of euphemisms and other ways that the people running the government try to define terms and use nomenclature to try to get people to think a certain way, by the same token, I think that that's partly behind the transformation and what the very word inflation means. Because again, it used to mean increasing money, and now it means an increase in prices. And just related to this point, I mean, Murray Rothbard, in his book Case Against the Fed, he makes a pretty funny point that it's astounding that here you have the Federal Reserve officials, the people that are in charge of the U.S. Central Bank, who vow that we're going to do our best to fight inflation, and that's one of our primary mandate is the stability of the purchasing power of the dollar, and that's what we're going to do. We're choosing our policies to, you know, avoid volatility in prices and that sort of thing. When, especially over the long term, the only reason the dollar is weakening is precisely because the Fed keeps pumping new dollars into the economy. Right? So it's like an arsonist vowing to fight fires or something. I mean, it's absurd. But again, it's not as obvious to the public how absurd it is if you're defining inflation as rising prices. Okay, so before we can really get too technical here, let's just make sure we understand what we mean by the price of money. Because ultimately where we're going with this, we're going to try to explain the purchasing power of money and why money can become stronger or weaker. And so what I want you to realize is that it's actually not this whole new topic that we need to learn. We already have the tools that we need because money is just a commodity. Okay, so we already know, and you know, we already taught you how to explain the formation of prices in barter. Right? Remember the candy bar example. We had the two kids with different combinations of candy bars, and they start swapping things based on their preferences, and that's how you can get an exchange rate. So you can figure out, oh, what's the price of a Snicker bar in terms of, Milky Way. And so, oh, if two Snickers trades for one Milky Way, well, then that's the implicit price ratio there. The price of one Snickers is half of a Milky Way bar. And the price of one Milky Way bar is two Snicker bars. Okay, so that's how you do it there. When it comes to money, it takes a little bit of a mental adjustment because we're used to quoting prices in money. But don't get too hung up on that. It's not that money is this qualitatively different thing. Money is a commodity, and you can use the same approach to understand money prices. It's just that money happens to be the one, the unit that we use to denominate all the other prices. Okay, so instead of saying, like, suppose it is the case that two Snicker bars exchange for one Milky Way. If somebody says, hey, how much, what's the price of a Milky Way bar? Most people aren't going to say, oh, two Snickers. No, they're going to say, whatever, 50 cents. And then you say, well, what's the price of, two Snickers bars? You say, oh, that's 50 cents also, because two Snickers trades for one Milky Way. So it would be the same price for those different quantities. And then if you wanted to say, well, the price of just one Snicker bar, you'd cut it in half and say 25 cents. Okay, so what money does for us, remember, and I think I explained this in a separate lecture about the benefits of money, is that we don't have to walk around having 2 billion different individual exchange ratios in our heads. Right? We don't need to know what Milky Way's trade for in terms of Snickers bars. All we need to know is, for every single good, how many units of money does that thing trade for? And then you can just, you know, use multiplication to figure out anything else you want, or division, to figure out anything else you want to know. Okay, so again, that's one of the functions of money, is that by exchanging everything against money, we only need to know one set of prices. Okay, whereas if you didn't have money, if you were in a state of barter, and you know, you might exchange your fish for coal, and your coal for diamonds, and your diamonds for water, then you'd have just a lot more prices you'd have to remember. Okay, but so again, quoting things in terms of money simplifies things and allows us to make calculations much more quickly, and it just speeds up or facilitates transactions. Okay, so having said that, though, again, don't think that money is this separate thing lying outside of the laws of economics, or that we're developing new laws to explain it. That's not what's going on here. I'm just showing you there's a little bit of a tweak involved, but it's the same concept. All right, so the definition here: the price of money is its purchasing power, meaning how many goods and services someone would need to offer in order to buy a unit of money. All right, so just make sure, you know, to really get what's going on in today's lecture, this is really the most important element of it. If you get this, the rest of the stuff is pretty straightforward, but this part's a little bit tricky. All right, so what I'm saying here is, we know, we're saying, well, what's the price of a car? Say, oh, the price of a car, maybe it's $10,000. So if you think through, what does that mean? It means if you want to go acquire a car, if someone's out there selling a car and you want to buy it, to say its price is $10,000, that means you have to hand over 10,000 units of money in order for the person who owns the car to be willing to part with it and to give you the property. So when you say, what's the price of money, what that would mean is, if I don't have money and I need to sell something to get it, or I need to offer something in exchange in order to buy money, to acquire it, how many units do I have to give up? Okay, so the only thing that's odd here is it's not obvious which unit you would use to price money in, because that's what we use money for, is we use money to be the common denominator for everything else. So we say, how much does a car cost? You say, oh, that car has a price of $10,000. You say, how much does a bag of apples cost? You say, oh, that costs $2. And how much does a house cost? That costs $200,000. All right, so see what I'm doing there is, for the price of everything, I'm quoting it, I'm denominating it in units of the money. So now if I say, well, how much, what's the price of money? Well, I could say the price of a dollar bill is $1, you know, to be consistent, right? That I'm saying for the price of everything else, the car, what else did I say? The house and the bag of apples. When you said, what's the price of those things? I told you in terms of dollars. So it's a perfectly correct answer if you say, what's the price of $1 bill, for me to say, well, the price of that is $1. That's a true statement, but it doesn't really tell us too much, right? Because I'm just, you know, I'm not really telling you something about the world. I'm just almost giving you a definition right back. Yeah, of course, the price of a dollar is $1. But, so when we say, what's the price of money, we want to flip it around. So normally when we talk about the price of goods and services, the prices of goods and services, we're saying how many units of money do you have to give up to get them, to get one unit of them. And so now when I say, what's the price of money, we take the reciprocal, we flip it around. So I could say the price of $1 bill is 1/10,000th of a car. And I could say the price of a dollar bill is 1/2 of a bag of apples. Okay? Because remember, a car, the price is $10,000. So if $10,000 bills trade for one car, well then $1 bill only trades for 1/10,000th of a car. And it takes $2 bills to buy a bag of apples, well then it takes $1 bill to get you half a bag of apples. Or if you want to have the fractions go the other way, you could say, suppose a gumball is 25 cents, right? So you get four gumballs for $1. And so I say, what's the price of a dollar bill? He said, oh, it's four gumballs. So the way to think about that is to say, if I'm the merchant and I'm selling gumballs and I want to buy money, I want to acquire money, what do I have to give up for? Oh, I have to give up four gumballs for every dollar bill that I want to entice a consumer to give me. Okay, so that's the way to think about it. So if you can... think about it like that. If you understand what I just was talking about there the last 5 minutes, the rest of this is pretty straightforward. So let me just say it again in other words. When we're talking about the price of money, we mean its purchasing power. We're saying if the price of money is higher, that means if you don't have money and you want to get some of it, or if you have money but you want to acquire more, that for every unit of money you want to acquire, or buy, if you will, you have to give up more units of other stuff. That's what it means if money has a high price. Because it's saying for every unit of money that you want to acquire, you have to offer a large number of units of other things. So that, again, the only real hitch there is it isn't coming up with, well, what goods and services do you want to use is the units to measure the price of money. Because again, money, what it does, because it's on one side of just about every transaction, it is the thing that is the standard. It's like the measure of the prices of everything else. And so that the fact that money is the one common denominator we use to quote the prices of everything else, so it's not ambiguous. When you say, hey, what's the price of a calculator? And I say $50. And you say, what's the price of a bag of apples? And I say $2. There was no question when I said, what's the price of those things, that I knew to quote it in terms of the money unit. When you say, what's the price of a calculator? I don't say, well, do you mean if you're exchanging it for avocados or if you're exchanging it for tomato seeds? They say, no, I mean if you exchange it for units of money. What are you talking about? That's what everyone means by the word price. Okay, so there's no ambiguity there because that's what we use money for. So then that breaks down, or that gets weird when you say, okay, what's the price of money? Because then it's not obvious what to use, because the price of a dollar is in principle the exchange rate against every other possible good or service in the whole economy. because dollars trade for all those things. And so it's just to make sure you understand what I'm saying here, I haven't given you enough information if I tell you the price of a dollar is 1/10,000th of a car. Because maybe you're not looking to buy a new car. And so you might not care how many cars a dollar bill gets you. Whereas if I tell you the price of a car is $10,000, that's all you need to know. Right? You don't need to know, well, wait a minute, how much does a car cost in terms of apples? You don't care. You say, what's the price of a car? And I say $10,000. Okay, that's all you need to know. Because again, this is just how automatic it is. I'm just trying to make us think about things that we take for granted because we quote everything in terms of the money unit. So, but then when you flip it and I say, well, what's the price of a dollar bill? It's not obvious which price I should give to you. Should I quote it in terms of cars, in terms of apples, in terms of tomato seeds? So in practice, what economists do is they come up with a basket of goods. All right, and so you probably have heard of the consumer price index. So there the idea is you say, okay, let's look at a bunch of things that a typical household has to buy, like milk and eggs and bread, and how much they have to pay in rent to live in a house or to rent an apartment, gasoline to drive around, that kind of stuff. And so they say, a given household needs to make these purchases, so you have this basket of goods that that go into constructing the consumer price index. And so then I'm dumbing it down a little bit, but the idea is you say from month to month, how many dollars does it take, or whatever your currency is in your country, how many units of money does it take the average household to buy this quantity of things, like, a gallon of milk, a package of loaf of bread, and pound of potatoes, and that sort of stuff. A gallon of fuel, a rent in the apartment, and that sort of thing. And then you just look and see how does that change over time. And so that is supposed to be a gauge of the purchasing power of money. And so over time, what happens typically is it takes more and more dollars to buy that basket of things that the typical household needs. And so that's the sense in which we can say, the value of money is falling, the price of money is falling, price inflation is rising, because now it takes consumers more and more dollar bills to get the same basic staples of life. Okay, that's the idea. So I'm glossing over a lot of the details, and things get tricky, like the fact that, a car today is a lot cooler than a car in 1950. And so if you're trying to see how much has the purchasing power of money changed between now and 1950, it's not enough just to say, well, gee, a new car costs a lot more today than it did in 1950, because they're actually different goods, right? A new car today is a much better product than a new car in the year 1950. All right, so there's all kinds of issues like that, but I'm just trying to get you to see the basics of it, that when you want to define the price of money, you mean its purchasing power, but it's more of an art rather than a science when it comes to defining that, is what I'm trying to get at here. Okay, the different economists might have different views as to what should go into that basket of goods that we're going to then use to sort of track the purchasing power of money over time. Okay, but forgetting those sort of practical difficulties, as long as you get the basic idea, then we can go on to the next step here. So we say, okay, now we have a general understanding of what the price of money is, just saying the exchange rate of a unit of money against other goods and services. And so we say, well, then what determines that price? Well, it's a price, so what determines it? Supply and demand. And so you have you can have your standard supply and demand graphs. But here, so the only thing you got to be careful about here is on this y-axis, the price. Remember, if we're talking about the supply and demand for money, then the price is not in terms of units of money. It's in terms of real goods and services. Okay, so if the price is higher on this y-axis, that means that prices in general are lower. Okay, so let me, that this is a crucial point, so I'm going to say it again in other words. Okay, so again, we're looking at this chart here, standard supply and demand chart. If I didn't tell you what this was, you might think it was supply and demand for in the market for apples. So what would that mean for that P? If the P goes up, what would you say? Is it, oh, the price of apples is higher, the higher that P is. Meaning that maybe at one level it's $5 for a pound of apples, and if it goes up higher, maybe that means it's $8 per pound of apples. Okay? So with other goods and services, if we're not talking about money, with other goods and services, the higher the price is, obviously that means the more units of money it takes to buy a unit of that thing. That's what it means, because the price is quoted in terms of money. So for every other good and service, a higher price is the same thing as saying a higher number written on the price tag. But with money, it's the opposite. It's the reciprocal. With money, when you draw your supply and demand curves for money, and if the prices goes up, that means the purchasing power of money goes up. So that means a given unit of money can exchange for more units of goods and services. So that means the price tags on those goods and services are actually going down. Okay, so let me just give you an example to make sure you're not getting mixed up. So originally, let's say that the price of a new car is $10,000. So we already said, okay, the price of the car quoted in money is $10,000 for one car. But what if I want to say, what's the price of money? Well, then it's the reciprocal. I say, oh, the price of $1 bill, for example, is 1/10,000th of this new car. Okay, so there I'm giving you the same information. I'm just dividing it. I'm quoting it in terms of cars instead of in terms of money. Okay? Because, again, remember, the principles we're using here are the same thing we did back in the chapter with the candy bars. So if two Snickers trades for one Milky Way and you say, what's the price for this exchange? There's two ways I can do it. I can say, well, the price of one Milky Way bar is two Snickers, or I can divide and I can say the price of one Snickers is 1/2 of a Milky Way. Okay, I'm giving you the same information. I'm just choosing one or the other as the unit, you know, the denominator, the one unit, and then the other one you have to adjust appropriately. So it's the same thing with money. If instead of having candy bars on both sides, what if on one side we have cars and the other side we have dollar bills? It's the same basic principle. So normally we're used to quoting prices in terms of money. So we say one car, its price is $10,000. That means if there's going to be a trade, the one person hands over $10,000 bills, loosely speaking, and the other person hands over one car. So that's a perfectly valid way to quote the price. But what if I say, well, no, quote the price in terms of how many cars trade for $1 bill? Well, then again, you just divide. Okay, so $1 bill trades for 1/10,000th of a car. Okay, so now what if I say that the purchasing power of money doubles? Okay, that money becomes twice as valuable in terms of its exchange rate with other goods and services in the marketplace. So in terms of this diagram that we're looking at right here, that would mean the supply and demand change for some reason so that this P on the y-axis here goes up twice as high. All right? So now in terms of that car, you say, okay, before it was a dollar bill traded for 1/10,000th of a car. So now, how many cars can I get with $1 bill? You see, you can get double that. And so, you know, you got to remember how to do fractions in your head, but what's twice of 1/10,000th? Well, it's 2/10,000th, which is 1/5,000th. And so what does that mean? It means the price sticker on the car, on the dealership, before it said $10,000 on it, now the dealer comes out, he makes an X through that and writes $5,000. Okay, so in normal everyday language, we would say the price of that car just went down by 50%. It went from $10,000 down to $5,000. So we would say, oh, prices are falling. But what that means, that's the same thing as saying the purchasing power of money is growing. Okay, let me use the gumball example so the fractions are easier and make it easier. So, okay, so originally, suppose that $1 bill gets you 4 gumballs. And so for people who are in the United States and familiar with our change, you know what that means is that one gumball has a price of 25 cents. Again, for foreigners, a cent is 1/100th of a dollar. So 25 cents is the same thing as $0.25. Okay, so originally the price, you know, the price tag at the grocery store when you go see the gumballs and the little dispenser, you know you have to put in a quarter to get it, which is 1/4 of a dollar or 0.25 of a dollar. And now I want to say that that the purchasing power of money increases. It doubles. So what do we know now? Well, now we say that for $1, you get 8 gumballs. Okay, so the price per gumball now has gone from 25 cents down to 12.5 cents. Okay, because you get 8 gumballs now per dollar bill. Okay, so again, what I'm showing you there is if the purchasing power of money goes up, that's the same thing as saying the price tags of everything else in the economy are going down. That's what a general rise in the purchasing power of money means. And of course, it's the other way around. That what would it mean to say the purchasing power of money is dropping? So in terms of this diagram, if the P is moving down, if the new equilibrium P, when you change supply and demand, if the new P ends up lower than the original P, it means prices in general, quoted in terms of money, are going up. Okay, so again, I think I belabored the point enough. We can move on here, but I just wanted to make sure you get it, that prices of everything else move in the opposite direction as the price of money. And if that word price of money is confusing you, just use the term purchasing power, because I think that's less liable to confusion. Okay, so if we're looking at this diagram now, you say, okay, well, what? Now you have a general idea of what it means for the price of money to move up and down, and what determines it. Again, don't get intimidated by it. Money is a commodity. It's a special type of commodity, but it is a commodity. And just as supply and demand explains the price of apples, supply and demand can be used to explain the price of a unit of money. So ultimately, when you want to understand why did the price of money change, whether it went up or down, it's because something must have happened to the supply and or the demand of it. So we can see right away here that if I start pushing the supply curve to the right, what is that going to do, other things equal? If I'm holding the demand for money constant and I'm moving the supply curve to the right, that's going to lower the price of money. And so what does that mean? Well, if the price of money is dropping, that means the purchasing money power of money is dropping. So the reciprocal means the price tags of everything else in the economy are going up. Okay, so that's the simple intuition behind it. So if, you know, whatever institution is in charge of the stock of money, so if it's in a modern economy where there's a central bank and the money is just pieces of paper and electronic representations of that I'm not going to get into because it's kind of complicated. Okay, but just think about it in terms of, in the United States at least, with dollar bills, green pieces of paper with pictures of presidents on them. If Ben Bernanke runs the printing press and prints up a trillion more of those things and hands them out to people, well, there's a larger quantity of money out there, okay? And technically, I'm not sure. Well, let me just, I'll finish this main point and then I'll give you the little caveat. Okay, so just think of that right now as the supply of money increasing. And so then if the supply increases and the demand stays the same for the moment, then you see the price goes down, and that's equivalent to saying that the prices of everything else in terms of money go up. And so if you just think about that, that makes obvious sense. That if there's a trillion more dollar bills floating around, people have more dollar bills that they can use to go buy stuff with. And so, you know, a common way people describe it is they say there's more money chasing the same amount of goods and services. And so the price tends to go up, the price quoted in money. Okay? So when you're trying to understand why is it year after year that prices quoted in money for most goods and services keep getting higher and higher and higher, what's going on here? Well, it's because partly the government and the central bank keep flooding the economy with more and more money. So it shouldn't be surprising. Just like if I'm trying to think of something that's indestructible, because part of the issue here is, you know, you might say, well, every year farmers keep flooding the world with more and more apples, but we eat them, so they disappear. Okay, so really the issue is just, are there more apples produced next year than this year, and then maybe the price of apples will go down. But with money, it doesn't disappear. Every time they dump more and more money in the economy, that just adds to the old amount, right? It's not that we eat the money and that it has to be replenished. Okay, I mean, money does wear away, and they do replace that, but I'm saying on top of that, they add new quantities of money every year. Okay, so that's that's the main point of this lecture. Like, make sure you get that and you understand the connection there and how it's really quite simple. So again, just as we understand if the apple harvest is particularly high, and so there's more apples coming on the market, other things equal, the price of apples is going to be lower. So by the same token, if the dollar harvest is really high and there's a bunch of new dollar bills coming into the market because the Fed is flooding the market with money, well then, other things equal, the price of a dollar bill is going to be lower, which means a dollar bill will get you less stuff, which means prices quoted in dollars are going to be higher than they used to be. So that's why when you're talking to your grandfather and he says, oh, back in my day, things used to be a lot cheaper. A dollar could really get you something back in my day, and now a dollar isn't worth anything. I mean, that's what's going on, that there are a lot more dollar bills floating around today than when your grandfather was in his prime. Okay, now a couple little technical things. So if you followed me up to there, that's great. That's the main part of the lecture. That's the essence of it. Now let me give you some more of the technical details here. Strictly speaking, it's a little bit tricky to understand these supply and demand curves. Okay, because remember, the supply of something, the supply curve, is showing you at various hypothetical prices how many units are going to be brought to market. Okay, so it gets a little bit tricky if you want to use that concept correctly when it comes to money. Okay, so loosely, before I was just mostly talking about how many dollar bills are in existence. And you might, you know, if you're really sharp, you might say, well, wait a minute, but like if we were talking about the apple market, the supply curve, this line that you're drawing for apples, that doesn't tell me how many apples exist. That's telling me how many apples would exist at various possible prices, or at least how many would be brought to the market for sale. And so that's a little bit, you know, that's not quite the same thing. All right, and so that's, if you're being troubled by that sort of consideration, that's good. That shows that you're really sharp and you're thinking through this stuff carefully. In the textbook, I give a little bit in the footnotes, I believe, about the way you would answer that question. But for this lecture right now, I don't want to go down that path because it gets kind of complicated. And it also depends, like, are we talking about an economy that uses gold? In which case, it's real straightforward. It's just, yeah, the higher the price is of the money, meaning the gold, then the more units of gold the people who hold the gold mines are probably going to bring to surface, right? Because it's if the price of gold goes up in a world that uses gold as money, then that means, you know, the prices of everything else in terms of gold ounces is lower. And so if you own a gold mine, you're going to have the incentive to go hire more workers and to get more explosive equipment and to, you know, dig more shafts and everything and bring more gold out of this to the surface so you can then use it to go buy railroads and invest in banks and do all kinds of other stuff with it. Okay, so there, you know, to understand how many pounds of gold are going to be mined and then brought into the market by the owners of the gold mines, well, then, yeah, it's this standard supply and demand framework makes perfect sense. Because they're producing gold just like the people who own copper mines are producing copper. And if copper goes up in price, they're going to tend to produce more. It's the same thing with gold, if gold happens to be the money. Okay, so there it's straightforward. Where it gets really complicated is if you have a central bank that's doing it, because then they're not really in it for profit. You know, they're guided by other considerations, and it's not as clear what does it mean to talk about the supply curve of dollar bills as determined by Ben Bernanke. Okay, so anyway, I'm just warning you that if you want to really push it, you got to start. Defining the institutional arrangements and things like that, so it gets tricky. As far as the demand for money, here, too, again, it gets really complicated pretty once you, like, step into the water, you're in the deep end pretty quickly is what I'm getting at. And so that's why I'm being a little bit vague here. Certainly, if you want to know more about this stuff, you should read Murray Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State is where this is explained thoroughly, but yet you don't need to have background knowledge. Like, if you read my textbook, you're ready. You can start reading Man, Economy, and State. I mean, it's a big book, and it's daunting, but it's just because it's so big. It's not that any particular section is really hard to get through. But just for right now, just to point you in the right direction, so the demand for money, just be clear here, what that means is it's not saying so much, do people want more money? Because, yeah, everybody wants more money. In the same way, you know, the demand for diamonds, if we were going to draw here a supply and demand framework for the market for diamonds, that wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't be saying there, oh, so some people don't want diamonds, or, you know, what does that mean? No, everybody, if you just said, hey, I have this brand new diamond here that's a certain amount of carats, do you want it? Just about everyone's going to say, sure, I'll take that. Okay, so the question isn't just in the abstract, do people want more diamonds? No, what does it mean when you draw a supply and demand curve for diamonds? That demand curve is saying at various possible prices of diamonds, how many units do people want to exchange money for? Okay? And so when it comes to money, if we're doing the market for money itself, which is what we're doing now, and you say, what's that demand curve for money mean? It's saying for various possible purchasing powers of money, how many units do people want to acquire? And so what that's actually saying is, at any given time, for the money market, if you will, the market for actual cash to be in equilibrium. It's saying people have done their trades, they've sold their labor, they've sold their cars, they've sold their gumballs and so forth to acquire money, and now, you know, there's no more gains from trade. Okay, so it's an odd thing, because you say, why are people holding money? What's the point of it? Because you think that the point of getting money is to spend it, right? That's what you want money for, is because you can go buy stuff. And so it seems that hang on a second here. Can people still hear me? Because some people in the chat box are saying freeze. So are you guys, is this video still working? Hang on a second. Just doing a check here, make sure that people can still see the video. Okay. All right, great. Okay, so back to what we're saying here. The demand curve for money, what does it mean? And again, I'm just going to sort of show you where the promised land lies, but I can't take you to it because it gets really complicated, and it's way beyond the scope of this class. So I just want people to understand, to have a rough idea of what do we even mean when we're talking about the demand for money? So why do people hold money? That's the thing to think about here. So again, we're not talking about people wanting to get richer. That's the important thing. Because normally, a lot of people, when they hear the word money, they think wealth. And so if somebody says, hey, do you want more money? Most people think that means, do you want to be richer? Do you want your net worth to go up? And so people, oh yeah, sure. But that's not what we're talking about here. I mean, it's almost better if instead of using the word money, use the word cash, because that might help keep in mind, in your mind, the fact that you're talking about the actual money commodity. You're not just talking about wealth per se. So what I mean is that suppose I really did walk up to you and give you $1 million in cash, and, you know, you weren't worried that I was a drug dealer and that someone was going to come take it from you, okay? That it was, for some reason, it was yours free and clear, and I just give it to you. You aren't going to keep it in that form, okay? Your first thing is probably you're going to go put it in the bank, right? Because you're afraid someone's going to steal it from you, or your house is going to burn down, you're going to lose it. So you're certainly not going to keep $1 million in actual currency on your person or in your house. That'd be incredibly risky. Okay, so probably what you're first going to do is you're going to be panicked and be like looking over your shoulder and worried that you're going to faint or something and someone's going to take it from you. So you're probably going to drive right to your bank and deposit it and be sweating bullets until you see that it's in the bank's vault, and you look at your balance and they give you the deposit slip and, holy cow, I got $1 million in my bank account. That's crazy. Or maybe you have like $1,000,083, because after you hit 83 cents in there before. Okay. But even there, you're not going to just let $1 million sit in your bank account, your checking account. You're probably going to do stuff with it. You're probably going to, first of all, you might go have some fun. You might go out to dinner. You might call up your boss and tell him what you really think of him, that kind of stuff. But beyond that, you're probably going to use some of it to go make investments. Like if you're worried about hyperinflation, you're probably going to take out some of it and go buy a bunch of gold coins. Or maybe you're going to buy stocks in Asia or whatever. Maybe you're going to buy a farm out in North Dakota or something and go move there and get a bunch of ammunition and cans of tuna fish because you think the big one's coming. Okay, but you see, my point is you're not actually going to sit on $1 million in cash. okay? Because that is much more than you want to hold at that moment. And so you're going to get rid of it, or at least a lot of it, okay? So that's what I'm trying to get you to see here is that the demand for money is the demand to hold money. Okay, so it doesn't go all the way. Okay, in other words, how can I put it? So I've just convinced you, I hope, that even if someone just out of the blue gave you $1 million in cash, you wouldn't hold it in cash for very long. You would get rid of the cash and acquire other things with it. Okay, so it's in your mind, you might say, no, I didn't get rid of $1 million. You might say, oh, I only spent $1,000. You know, I got my wife a $500 necklace, and we went out to a really fancy dinner, and then I bought a new suit for myself, but that was all I spent. The rest of it I invested. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that terminology. But I'm saying even if you took a bunch of it and bought gold coins and put some in your 401k and did this and that, my point is you didn't keep it as $1 million in currency, okay, because you didn't want to hold that much money. You wanted to hold other assets, all right? So, on the other hand, when all is said and done, or even right now, if I say how much money do you have to your name, and I clarify and I say no, I mean actual money. It's not going to be zero, at least for most of you, right? You actually have right now in your wallet or your purse some cash, and in your checking account you've got a positive balance probably that you can, you know, quickly access with your debit card, or you can use your debit card to, you know, make purchases at the store or whatever, drawing down on that cash, right? So even though you wouldn't keep the whole $1 million in cash, you also wouldn't have zero. You have some money. Okay, so at any given time, if you go around the whole economy and you add up the actual cash balances of every single person, including all the merchants and everything, and all the corporations, well, that is the total economy's demand for money, okay? Because the money at any given time, let me put it this way, money is never in circulation, okay? At any given moment in time, in any snapshot, every dollar bill or whatever, you know, every euro or whatever the currency is in your country, every unit of money is owned by somebody. Or if it's owned by a corporation, then it's, you know, partially owned by all the shareholders. All right? So it's always in someone's possession, and that's what money is. So yes, when you make an exchange, even there, it's not so much that the money is in circulation, it's that you just transfer property titles. So if you think money is in circulation, well, then you also have to think apples are in circulation. Because how do you buy apples? One person starts out with money, the other person starts out with apples, and then they swap. And that's what it means to buy apples. So if you think, oh, that was money in circulation, okay, but then you got to think that apples are in circulation. And most people don't talk like that. Okay, so what happens with money is people hold it because they expect to make future purchases, and then when they do make the purchase, they swap it. And why are the people on the other side of the transaction accepting the money? Is because they want to hold it, because eventually they're going to use it. All right, so it's true. That's the funny thing about money, is you acquire it knowing full well you're going to get rid of it, and that's in fact why you want to acquire it. But nonetheless, while you're holding it, that's your demand for money. Okay, and you're willing to give up other goods and services to acquire it. Okay, so in terms of the supply and demand curves, what happens when we're in equilibrium is that the purchasing power of money has to be the right level so that the total amount of money that people want to hold is exactly equal to how much money exists at that moment. All right. Okay. Very quickly, let me just give you a little bit of a hint. You might say, why is the demand curve downward sloping? What does that mean? Well, it's similar to everything else. So if it's, what does it mean when the the price of money drops, it means that the purchasing money, power of money, goes down. So that means the prices of everything else are going up. And so what that means is, if everything else, if the prices of everything are going up, people want to hold more money. So on the one hand, you understand it's obvious because it's easier to get money. So your wage rate's probably higher, your salary's probably higher. But also the things you want to do with money, if you want to go buy stuff with it, if prices in general are rising, then you're going to want to have a bigger stockpile of money. So for example, when your grandpa says, oh my gosh, back in my day, you know, you could go to McDonald's and get a cheeseburger for 15 cents or whatever. If you said to grandpa, back then, in any given, you know, in a normal weekday, how much money did you have in your wallet? The number he tells you is probably going to be a lot lower than the number you have in your wallet right now, or an adult has, depending on how old you are. Okay, so over time, not only is it the case that the prices of things in general go up, but the amount of money that you have, that you're holding, your demand for money, the quantity you're demanding as an individual, goes up as well. Okay? All right. Well, we're getting low on time here, so I've got to move on. Now, let me give you one cautionary point here. There's a danger in just thinking about money in terms of the supply. And so it's true when you want to, like, over the course of the 20th century, if you want to say, why is it that the dollar has lost so much of its purchasing power, my immediate response is going to be, oh, because the Federal Reserve flooded the market with so much more money. But it's, remember, money is a commodity and its price is set by supply and demand. And so you have to be careful. So it is possible for the demand to hold money to change based on other things. So for example, look at this chart. This is from the textbook, by the way. You can see that, so what this is showing is it's the top line is the quantity of money, it's the M1 monetary aggregate. It doesn't really matter for our purposes what that means. It's just a fairly narrow definition of how many dollar bills there are in the economy. And then the other line is showing the price level. And so you can see that for a while, from about 1960 to about 1983 or so, they moved pretty much in tandem. But then from that point onward, you see the quantity of dollar bills rose a lot more than the price level did. And so what was going on there is that the demand to hold dollars must have increased, or at least increased more than the supply of dollars. Okay, so that's what's going on there. Okay, now why did that happen? There's lots of possible reasons. Globalization, you know, as the dollar, people around the world started holding dollars instead of their own currencies. Another possible explanation is that the big tax cuts and deregulations of the early Reagan years, and also the fact that they got price inflation under control, that price inflation had been really high in the late 70s, and then those rates came way down. So now the dollar was a much more attractive currency because of those policy changes, and so that would make investors around the world more likely to want to put their wealth in things denominated in dollars. They'd want to invest in the U.S., loosely speaking. And so in order to do that, they had to take their own currency and use it to buy dollars, and then use those dollars to buy stuff in the United States. Okay, so that those are various reasons why the demand for dollars was rising in this period, and so that could partially offset the fact that the quantity of dollars was increasing. Okay, so what I'm trying to do is explain to you, why is it that prices of things in the United States measured in terms of dollars didn't increase as much as you would have thought just looking at the increase in the total amount of dollar bills. And I'm saying partly it's because the demand to hold dollars also rose fairly rapidly through this period. Okay, so another way of putting this is to say, if the supply of dollars had been constant, right, if the quantity of dollar bills had been flat, then prices in the United States would have dropped significantly over these decades as foreigners wanted to hold more and more dollars as their demand went up for it, because then you would have had demand increasing while supply stayed the same, so that would have meant the price of dollar bills going up, meaning the prices of everything quoted in dollars would have gone down. Okay, so anyway, but the moral for this is you can't just look at the supply side. You have to also look at the demand side. Okay, commodity versus fiat money, and we're already past the hour mark here, so I'll wrap this up. And right now some people are confused. Right now I'm looking at slide number 11 in this PowerPoint show, so commodity versus fiat money. Let me just give you a little bit of a historical explanation here. So we talked about, I forget the exact chapter number, but we went over the fact earlier in the course that money emerged spontaneously on the market. Okay, a government or a wise king didn't invent money. So, and historically, the market has gravitated towards the precious metals. Gold and silver is the world money of choice. And I think that if governments around the world and central banks butted out of it and let free individuals conduct their own affairs again in terms of finances, that once again, I think gold would become the world money, at least for the foreseeable future. So why is it then that nowadays people in the United States use dollars, people in Europe use the euro, and just about every major advanced country and even not so advanced country around the world, the people use pieces of paper? Well, that's a long story, but what happened is historically governments would get involved and they would first get their people in a position where instead of using actual gold coins to make their purchases, like, so you would go in the store and say, hey, how much is this thing? Oh, it's 2 ounces of gold, and people would pull out gold coins. Instead of doing it that way, they would use the denominations, the units of the national currency. But the way they got people to be comfortable with doing that is the currency was linked to the precious metal. So I'm most familiar with the United States. So in the United States, for several decades, up until 1933, if the official exchange rate was $20.67 would get you an ounce of gold. All right, so if you went up to the U.S., a branch of the U.S. Treasury, and you had $20.67 in currency, they had to give you an ounce of gold. I mean, there might have been a little margin they would charge you or something for the administration fee, but that was basically what that was. So the money issued by the government of the United States was like a claim ticket. It was like they were saying, we have the gold stored for you, and just as a courtesy, as a matter of convenience, you can use these pieces of paper with pictures of U.S. presidents on them to go make your transactions. But that stuff, the dollar, is as good as gold because we've got the gold stored here. So then in 1933, Franklin Roosevelt said, actually, forget that. Not only can U.S. citizens no longer turn in their dollars for gold, but actually anyone out there who has gold, you have to give it to us, and we're going to give you these green pieces of paper in exchange. And if you don't, you're going to go to jail, or we'll give you a big fine. And the fine was really, it was like $10,000 back in 1933 was the fine. All right, so it was a big fine. All right, and that's actually why the government had to build a gold depository at Fort Knox, for those of you who heard of that, was to store all the gold that FDR stole from everybody in 1933. Okay, and then even on top of that, they pay, because you might say, okay, well, at least merchants then could protect themselves. They could write contracts and say, okay, I'm going to buy this much stuff from you next year. You know, I'm going to buy this many bushels of wheat from you if you're a farmer. And the price you're going to pay me, yeah, you have to pay me in these green pieces of paper, these dollar bills, because of the government. But when we go to figure out what that price is, we'll look at the world markets and look at the price of gold. And so you just have to give me as many dollar bills as would, you know, have that I could use to then go get so many ounces of gold. But the government said, no, you can't have clauses like that in your contracts either. Okay? So not only couldn't you hold the gold and use it, you couldn't even write contracts based on the world price of gold. So the government of the United States was completely divorcing the American economy from its ability to use gold as money, and was forcing them to use dollars. And then for a long time, you know, there was the Bretton Woods Agreement, where the dollar, so even though American citizens had to use the dollar bills, at least central banks around the world, if they wanted to, they could exchange dollars for gold at the price of $35 for an ounce. And then in 1971, Richard Nixon stopped even that. And so that's when people say that Nixon closed the gold window, that's what they mean. That after 1971, the U.S. dollar is backed up by absolutely nothing. Okay, there's not some other asset waiting in the wings to sort of back up these green pieces of paper. They are their own thing. Okay, so that's what fiat money is. It's the term comes from the fact that, like, the government is declaring it to be money by fiat. That's what it means. That's how you remember it. All right, so as opposed to commodity money, which emerged in the marketplace as a genuine commodity that didn't have a monetary use. Okay, so gold and silver, historically, they were goods, right? They were used for other things, and then it was just because of their particular properties that they made excellent monies, and so that's why people began to use them as money. But gold and silver have other purposes, whereas green pieces of paper with pictures of U.S. presidents on them, they're not useful for anything. Okay. So, just got a few more slides here. The danger of government inflation. The principal thing here is, why is fiat money so dangerous? It's because it can be produced in limitless quantities. And that's why you had the German hyperinflation between the world wars, and that's what happened in Zimbabwe. Whereas if gold is the money, you don't have to worry about the quantity of gold going up by a factor of a billion in 1 year. Whereas you do have to worry about that in Zimbabwe and in interwar Germany, right? With fiat money, if the authorities want to, they can increase the quantity of money without limit, right? And so that's a huge danger. Now, maybe they won't do that. Maybe they won't be so reckless. But look, it has happened, right? It happened in Germany. It happened in Zimbabwe. A lot of people are worried that Ben Bernanke's playing with fire and that, you know, he's going to set us up to crash the value of the dollar. Okay, so what are the problems? Well, money loses its value when there's a hyperinflation in two ways. So the obvious way is that its purchasing power goes down very severely. And so that is bad because it wipes people out if they weren't expecting it. Okay, so that's what happened, for example, during, this is speculative, of course, but a lot of people think that the hyperinflation between the world wars is at least partially responsible for the rise of Hitler, because the middle class just absolutely got wiped out. A lot of people, you know, they had their savings. It wasn't so much that they had their savings in terms of marks, you know, the German mark, the currency that they had, it wasn't that they had the pieces of paper stuffed under their mattress, but a lot of people would have had savings that were denominated in marks, right? So that it, like maybe you had a pension plan that was going to pay you a certain number of marks per year, or maybe you had bonds that would pay you a certain number of marks per year. And so at the old price structure, you know, maybe that was going to be a comfortable retirement. Or maybe, you know, you had been, maybe you were 40, and you've been working for, 20 years, and you had built up a nice nest egg for yourself there, where, you know, you're going to pay for your kids, maybe, if you had some young kids that were going to still get higher education, or you know, fund your retirement, what have you. And then all of a sudden, the hyperinflation hits, and the amount of money that you had, you know, been socking away for 20 years and you thought was going to provide for your old age, now that can buy you a loaf of bread. One loaf of bread. I mean, stuff like that would happen. There is an example of Hitler, and I think it was in Mein Kampf, actually, related this anecdote where he was at some sporting event, I think, or there's something, I'm getting the details a little bit off, but there was some woman who was like a vendor, like, so she would set up when there was going to be like a big event, and I think like there was a big sporting event or there was a parade or some kind of thing, and so a lot of tourists were going to come into the city, and so she was really excited. She was going to, you know, make a killing. And so the people came in, and they, you know, and she sold out all of her stuff. You know, I don't even remember what she was selling, but like she, you know, she would sell souvenirs or something like that. She would, you know, just have a roadside stand. And so she benefited when there was some big event, and so a lot of tourists would come into the city. And so she was cleaned out, right? Everyone completely bought her whole inventory. So all she had left was money when all was said and done. And so she was really happy because she thought she just made a killing. You know, she had a great day. She literally sold everything. And then when she went to go buy new supplies, she realized that she had made a miscalculation, that she didn't realize how much prices had gone up. And so she didn't have enough money to even replenish what she started out with that morning. Okay, so in her mind, she just had the best day of her life in terms of her business. She completely sold out. She turned all of her product into dollar, or not dollar bills, into marks. And so in her mind, she should have been able just to spend a little bit of it and replenish her inventory. And then she should, you know, would have had a bunch left over for all her profit. And then she realized she couldn't even replenish her inventory because the prices of the stuff she needed to buy to make the stuff had all skyrocketed, and she didn't realize how fast those prices had gone up. Okay, so she got completely wiped out. And Hitler recounts this in Mein Kampf, all right? So so anyway, that's one part of it. Another thing, in terms of when I say money loses its value, I mean more generally that what is the function of money itself? Remember, it's the thing that's the common unit of exchange. So it's the thing that helps us do long-term planning. It's how we can determine if our business is profitable. It's how we make decisions like, okay, should we build this apartment complex? Should we invest a bunch of money to buy the land and erect the building and then start renting it out? You know, should we go ahead and do that or not? And based on what we think the rental income will be down the road. Okay, so my point is, you can't make calculations like that if price inflation is at 1,000,000,000% a year. And that's what it sometimes is. In Zimbabwe, the annual inflation rate at one point was over 1,000,000,000% a year. Okay, the price level was doubling at one point every 25 hours. Okay, I mean, we throw statistics around like that, and it's kind of meaningless. But, I mean, just think about that. That price has doubled in just over a day. That's incredible. When in Zimbabwe at its worst. Okay, so in that environment, money almost loses its meaning. It's almost like not having money at all. Okay, and then the last thing is inflation as engineered by governments and central banks is, in my opinion, what causes the boom-bust cycle. All right, or the business cycle is maybe how you refer to it. So why is it that we have these wild booms and then everything crashes, unemployment goes way up, and everyone's out of a job, and then there's a recovery, up, and then there's a boom again, up, and then it crashes. A lot of people think that that's just, oh, that's the market economy for you. There's these ups and downs, and it's just natural. And Austrian economists say, no, it's not natural. It's because of the banking system under the control of the central bank and in league with the government inflates, in the old sense of the term, inflates the money and credit supply that causes a boom, and then there's that leads to an inevitable crash, and then they do it again. All right, and so for this class, I don't want to take it further than that. I'm just pointing that out to you, and then that's the, I think it's the last chapter in the textbook, if you're curious, is where I go through and lay out the basics of that. So for our purposes right now, I'm just mentioning the reason inflation is bad or is dangerous. It's not simply that it erodes the purchasing power of the monetary unit, but also it comes and goes in spurts, and that's what contributes to the business cycle as we know it. Okay, so why don't we stop there? I went a little bit over, and again, I have to stop right on time here, so we've got about 13 minutes left for your questions. And while you guys are thinking, perhaps let me pull up the questions for the professor discussion board. Okay, so Jerry Claren says, in the wake of the natural disaster in Japan, what would happen in terms of U.S. inflation and prices if Japan needed to cash their U.S. treasuries in order to pay for rebuilding? I think they hold about $800 billion in treasuries, and their damages are around the $300 billion mark. Okay, so that's a good question. I had a Mises.org article. Actually, I even got it right here in my browser, so I'll post it if you're curious. So for those of you who are tuned in right now, I'll post the URL in the chat box. For those of you who are listening to this after the fact, the name of the article is The Japanese Currency Intervention, and that was at Mises.org, and it ran on March 23rd, 2011, if you want to see this spelled out in greater detail. But the quick answer, Jerry, is so your intuition is correct. So what happens is, and this is a good point, this is to show how the demand for dollars can affect their purchasing power. So here, what will happen is you've got people in Japan, and let's say it's a Japanese insurance company, okay? And so they have to pay a bunch of damage claims to their clients because, you know, the tsunami and so forth, earthquake caused a bunch of damage, and so you're the Japanese insurance company, and so you have to write out checks to a bunch of your customers. And, of course, those policies, since you're in Japan, you're a Japanese company, those policies are denominated in yen, right? That's, you know, those people were paying you premiums in yen, and they said if there's ever damage, you have to send us a check in yen. And if the Japanese company, if its assets, if a bunch of them happen to be in terms of U.S. treasuries, right, so they're collecting premium payments, people are paying them yen every month, you know, making their homeowners insurance payments and all that kind of stuff. And then what does the Japanese insurance company do? Well, it gets this in, it's got to make investments with it. And so maybe it thought a fairly safe asset class would be treasury securities, you know, meaning debt issued by Uncle Sam. So when they got there, the way they did it is they took their yen, they went to the currency markets, and then they bought dollars with the yen, and then used the dollars to buy treasuries. So at that time, what happened is that would strengthen the dollar, right? Because now the demand for dollars went up. So if they want to do the opposite, that's going to make the demand for dollars go down. Because what's going to happen is the Japanese insurance companies need to sell off their assets to raise yen. And so if partly what they do is they start selling their treasuries, so that, you know, they'll go to the bond market, sell treasuries, people will give them dollar bills for them, and then the Japanese insurance company will take those dollar bills, go to the currency market and say, I can't give my customer dollar bills, I need yen. So here I've got a bunch of dollar bills, who is willing to sell me yen for the dollar bills? And so that will, so what's happening there is, if you want to think about it, the demand for dollar bills is going down. And so that will at least temporarily push down the dollar price of the yen. So it'll be cheaper to buy yen, or sorry, it'll be more expensive to buy yen. I said that backwards. I'm even mixing up myself. It will make the dollar weaken against the yen. Let's be safe and just say it like that. Okay, so that will mean that the U.S. now, if it okay, sorry for the short freeze there. So just to repeat that last point, I was saying it might just be a short-term thing if they, to the extent of the people now getting the yen checks from the insurance companies in Japan, if they start buying food and tractors and things like that that are from the United States, then that will tend to strengthen the dollar, okay? And so, because they need to turn their yen into dollar bills to buy the John Deere tractors and to buy the wheat from American farmers and that kind of stuff. So in the grand scheme, it could just mean the Japanese people collectively are turning their U.S. Treasury assets into tangible goods like tractors and wheat, and then shipping them across the ocean and using them. So, I mean, if it were perfectly balanced, it probably wouldn't affect inflation in the United States at all in terms of general level of prices. Okay, but that's but you're right. Certainly, in the short term, the immediate impact of a bunch of Japanese people trying to turn their dollar holdings into yen would be to weaken the dollar and make prices in the United States go up. Okay. Stephen Davis has a good question. He says, what is your response to people who argue that, yes, the 1913 dollar is now worth 5 cents, but since 1948, the price level has increased by a factor of 10, whereas the average wage rate has increased by a factor of 25, so therefore real wages have increased by a factor of 2.5. Okay, so people just listening to the audio, this might have gotten a little bit lost with all those numbers. What Stephen is referring to is, I think he's referring to, there's this economist, David, I've actually got him open up on my browser too, let me go find it, make sure, David Andelfato, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And he works, I believe, at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. So lately, he has been taking on Ron Paul. He went so far as to call him a pinhead in his first blog post, and now he's being more civil because he got his head bitten off by a bunch of Ron Paul fans. But anyway, he is taking on this argument, so it's a very common rhetorical device that people who are against the Federal Reserve, like Ron Paul, will say, oh my gosh, the Fed says that it wants to, you know, preserve the purchasing power of the dollar, and that's one of its missions, is to, you know, keep inflation in check, price inflation in check. But look it, since the Fed was founded in 1913, the dollar has lost more than 95% of its value. So meaning the amount of goods and services that a dollar could buy you in 1913 today could buy you about 5% of that. Or looked at another way, the stuff you could buy in 1913 with a nickel, today it would take you a dollar, okay, roughly speaking. So that's a pretty strong argument, and the people who are against the Fed will use that sort of argument a lot. So this guy, Andelfato, thinks that's a silly argument. He says, they're making it sound like we're that much poorer, like we've lost 95% of our purchasing power, but look at over the same period, wage rates have gone way up too. And in fact, wage rates have gone up more than the general price level. And so if you're going to blame the Fed for making milk and eggs and bread more expensive, well, then by consistency, you have to credit the Fed for making your paycheck go way up. And in fact, your paycheck went up even more than the prices of all the other stuff. And so on net, you're benefiting if you're going to follow Ron Paul and sort of attribute all these things, these movements and prices to the Fed. Okay, so that's Andelfidel's argument. And so Stephen wants to know what I think about that. Well, I'm going to actually, this upcoming Monday, I'm going to have a Mises Daily on precisely this point. So in the 2 minutes we have left, I'll just give you the quick version of it. It's on the narrow point, he's right. Andelfidel is correct that it's not the whole story to just say, oh, since 1913, prices have gone up by such and such, meaning that, you know, the value of the dollar has been diluted down about 5%. You know, that by itself, you know, if somebody didn't know anything else about economics or about history, that statement wouldn't be particularly informative, okay? But even so, it's what's going on is every time the Fed inflates, and it's also the commercial banks too, they create money out of thin air too through fractional reserve banking, they are redistributing the wealth at that moment. All right, so just think of it this way. If some guy has a printing press in his basement and he's printing counterfeit $100 bills and he's going out buying Ferraris and going on cruises and eating caviar every night, there's no one would doubt that that guy is stealing from the rest of us. There's no doubt about it. Okay, that's why counterfeiting is immoral. It's because you're stealing from people. And so, you know, it's true that over time, what would happen if this counterfeiter is really running his printing press? Over the decades, prices would be higher than they otherwise would have been. And it's also true that wage rates would be higher than they otherwise would have been. Because the mere fact that he's printing up green pieces of paper, that doesn't change the fundamental long-run exchange rate between hours of labor and television sets, okay? So in, you know, in that sense, the dollar bills kind of just blow up the numbers on both sides of the transactions. But like the real exchange rates, how many hours you have to sell of your labor to acquire one television set, that by itself isn't going to be directly affected necessarily by him printing money. But certainly, you know, you wouldn't say it, but you wouldn't then conclude, so really he's not doing anything. No, the guy, every Ferrari he gets, every meal he has from printing that money, he is stealing from us. And so you have to scratch your head and say, well, what? How do we reconcile these two things? On the one hand, it looks like he's not doing anything, the prices would just adjust, and that, you know, all he's doing is making prices rise. On the other hand, it looks like he's ripping us off. So what's going on? And it's, so I'm going to resolve that more on Monday. We're kind of out of time right now, but I'm just pointing out that Andelfidel is not focusing on that. He does, like in a little sub-paragraph in response, because I challenged him, and I think that's why he brought it up, but he's ignoring that fact. And the big thing that he's ignoring is that it's not just the government that's benefiting from it. Okay, so he does deal with the fact that the government, through the Federal Reserve, skims money from the rest of us through this process called seniorage, but it's also the commercial banks, which he completely ignores. Okay, so anyway, to answer your question, see, it's all he's really shown is that your ability to earn income isn't permanently damaged because of inflation. But even so, every time the person with the printing press inflates, he's necessarily redistributing the wealth at that moment. And so, yeah, it's true that even, you know, if every month the counterfeiter prints up a bunch of money and acquires a new Ferrari, over time, the long-run impact is going to be prices are going to go up, including wages. But still, that stockpile of growing Ferraris that he keeps growing represents more and more theft that he's taken from everybody else. And there's no way around that. And so, and the fact that prices have risen so much is an indication of how much theft has been accumulated over those decades. Okay, so if the fact that the dollar has lost so much purchasing power shows you how many rounds of those bursts of inflation must have occurred. So it still is a rough proxy of how much we've been ripped off. It's true, though, that it's that fact per se doesn't tell it to you. You have to kind of know more about what's going on. But Andel Fadel just stops there. He says, no, wages went up. So end of story when he doesn't, you know, he's just ignoring the fact that there's been that systematic redistribution all along the path. Okay, like I said, I got a radio interview, so we do have to end on time here. So thanks, everybody, for the class. I hope you enjoyed it. And again, for those of you who are taking the class for credit, this week, week 10, you're going to have your regularly scheduled multiple choice quiz just on week 10. And then I will, you know, send out an email and make sure you have all the details for it. But next week, when, if you will, there would have been a week 11 quiz, instead of that, there's going to be a final exam. Okay, thanks, everybody.